This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Okay, welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Today we have a special guest panel joining us, and we're going to be talking about women and women's issues in the church. In particular, the role of women in society today is complex, but one thing is clear, that women are in transition, at least in their roles. Women often find themselves in the tension between polarizing roles and desires. The demands and expectations of the family, their career, their relationships, and society in general are changing and moving in different directions and putting people in sometimes complex situations. Today we are joined by a guest panel of women to discuss the changing place of women in the church today and what it means for the women striving to find their place. First of all, we're joined by Kimberly Ann. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, John.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. My name is Kimberly Ann, and I have four daughters. I live in Oklahoma and grew up in the church in Oklahoma. So as in the mission field, as opposed to a Utah Mormon, that was probably not the best thing to be a Utah Mormon from where I grew up. They were kind of like, oh, they're Utah Mormons, you know, a little bit different. Anyways, I grew up here in the church, as I said, and left the church about 5 years ago. Went ahead and had my name removed from the rolls, as well as the names of my children and my family. So that's my basic story. I'm an ex-mo, but I'm still the same person I've always been. I haven't really changed.
Great. We're also joined by Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, John. It's nice to be here. Let's see. Gosh, a little bit about me. I'm 45 years old. Also like Kimberly Ann, grew up in the church, except she's younger than I am. I have three children. I have two daughters, a 20-year-old, a 17-year-old, and we have a 5-year-old little boy. We have been married for, 24 years now, married in the Salt Lake Temple. I grew up in California, Northern California. Went to BYU, met my husband at the Y, he went on his mission week. I mean, you typical real sappy Saturday's Warrior story there. got married after he got back from his mission. So I have grown up in the church. Both of our parents have very strong ties in the church. His parents are extremely active. His folks, as a matter of fact, served as mission presidents in Texas not too long ago, and have served in, you know, callings such as stake presidents and bishops and that kind of thing. My folks, pretty much the same. My father was a convert to the church, there's a little bit different kind of balance there, but we always grew up very active. My dad was in the bishopric. My mom served lots of different callings in the church as well. Both of my husband and I have kind of done our share. So we're both very active still in the church. We live currently in Greensboro, North Carolina. Made a job move here in 1993. Kimberly Ann made an interesting point about Utah Mormons. That we lived in Utah for about 6 years before moving to North Carolina, and that was like being in the Twilight Zone. I literally almost completely lost my testimony. It was like being part of a completely different church living in Utah. So it's a whole different, it's a completely different culture as far as that goes.
That's true. And I realize that tonight we don't have anybody representing the home front. There's nobody on from Utah. So
you, John.
Well, I grew up there, but we're just down the street from Elizabeth these days. So Zilpha, of course, you recognize from previous podcasts, but why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Zilpha, John's wife. We've been married for 13 years. Got married way back then at the in the Bountiful Temple. We had met at BYU also. We left the church together about 4 years ago, give or take. And
we never really left the church.
Oh,
we just stopped going, right?
well, just inactive, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know if it's inactive. I wouldn't use that term.
the church probably would.
Yeah, the church would. We haven't taken our names off the records at any rate. And we have two children, a 5 and a 7-year-old.
Yes, that's true.
Boys?
Oh, a girl and a boy.
Oh, lovely. Okay.
Yeah, then they're pretty close together. They're what, 19 months apart?
Months apart.
Oh, 17. I don't mean to cheat you of the 2 months. Months. Yeah. Okay, in the introduction, I kind of hinted at that, you know, and society is changing for the role of women. I mean, that's obvious when you look back 30 years or 50 years, you know, both inside and outside religious institutions.
Yes.
But I think a good place for this conversation to start is for us to go back to just how in the church are the roles of men and women different today?
Today.
Okay. I think that, well, the biggest difference is structurally the men hold the priesthood, and the women also hold callings within the church, but they are part of more of the auxiliary association, which is the Relief Society, and there are things that women cannot do that men can do within the church. There are offices that men hold that women cannot hold. The priesthood holder is supposed to be the spiritual leader of the home and preside over the home in a righteous manner, which is pretty standard through any type of Christian doctrine that you take a look at throughout the Bible. The Mormon Church is pretty much a patriarchal order, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
Now, when you say that standard, maybe like if we went back in time 70 years, you're saying most Christian churches kind of followed that pattern, right? The men were the ones in charge.
Right. I mean, you look at the Catholic Church, you look at, as far as those kinds of things go, I mean, female preachers even now are, I mean, they're becoming more popular than they used to be, but just female authorities within different churches in general, I think, is a newer phenomenon.
I think that's true. And I wanted to bring out the part of the proclamation to the world, which is, you know, fairly modern, that says gender is an essential characteristic of individual premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose. So according to the church, what you are born as is what you always were and always will be as far as gender, and it encompasses, you know, everything about your destiny and what your role is, you know, for the eternities and in this life.
Right. So some things that I've found that are interesting are the fact that there seemed to be a big split in the types of things that women were allowed to do in regards to the impetus of the church when Joseph Smith was the prophet. And after he was killed and Brigham Young took over the church and there was a big exodus to Utah and that kind of thing, I really strongly feel that there were a lot of things that that shaped the church in a different direction based on a lot of based on Brigham Young's prejudices towards certain things. Because when Joseph Smith was the prophet, women did a lot more as far as priesthood type roles than they did when Brigham Young took over, and there were some significant changes made to the Relief Society when Brigham Young took over. When Joseph Smith was the prophet, women would typically give blessings for the sick. Perform, you know, those types of things were common.
But you know, you mentioned that in the early days of the church, the women could and did bless the sick. They also participated in something that was really common, which was speaking in tongues and interpreting the speaking in tongues, which is a big part of the worship at that point in time. And it, you know, it's lost completely from Mormonism today, of course. But women had a big role in that, and some of Joseph and Brigham's wives, who later went on to leadership roles, were big players in that. So that was another obvious and visible role that women had in the church at that time.
Mm-hmm. According to Quinn, he says that women originally, under the direction of Joseph Smith, were given a partial priesthood as a part of a temple ordinance that had to do with the endowment. And that was for polygamous wives. And it was the priesthood that they had allowed them to perform healings for the sick, but for other women. And that was not given to single women or women who were not sealed to a man. So the priesthood came from, you know, the sealing to the husband, and it was an extension of that. And I think that's in a way how it's still viewed partially. It's been 5 years since I've been to church, so I'm not up on the latest with that. But
when the church came out to Utah and started practicing polygamy in earnest, oftentimes men kept women, you know, very far apart from each other. They might have a wife in St. George and one in Salt Lake and one in Logan, for example, you know, spanning hundreds of miles. Well, the women enjoyed a certain sense of autonomy during that period, and they had to sort of fend for themselves much more than we push in the church today in this sort of idealized nuclear family. So I think that the women oftentimes had to take on many of those roles that might be, I don't know, denied to them today.
Because
and
they didn't
wonder,
have any other
it's
choice.
Interesting. I wonder, because now you see a lot more of, I mean, women are a lot more independent now. You see a lot more career-oriented women in the church now. And I'm wondering if a lot of that is, you know, again, I think the church kind of has really reflected the culture. And that culture is changing. I know that in my ward, here in North Carolina, more women work than don't work. I mean, that is the norm. We have a lot of our Relief Society lessons and those kinds of things. I've taught them. They revolve around education, around building your resume, computer skills. I mean, all of those kinds of things. Now you think about that 25 years ago, and people would have absolutely gasped. that would have been part of the norm. You know, oh no, you'd be doing.
I find it interesting.
Things, you know.
The women of the church seem to be evolving and moving forward, but the church itself seems stagnant when it comes to women's rights and when it comes to women's power and authority. They just don't recognize it still.
I see baby steps being made. Just as an active member, I see baby steps happening.
Doctrinally, though, at the core.
Yeah, there's not
there's
really
no change.
No, especially like I said with that proclamation to the world on the family. I mean, that's just as defining of the roles as anything has been, in my opinion.
And doctrinally, from the start, and even until this day. Women have held no ecclesiastical power of any kind without a man, mm-hmm. without borrowing any authority they have from a man. Even the Relief Society president is not autonomous. Every woman works under the authority of a male, even in their own families, or that's how it's supposed to work. Mm-hmm. A woman has less ecclesiastical authority than her 12-year-old son, who is ordained to the priesthood. I'm everyone's not like me, thank goodness, but I find that appalling. I can never, ever attend the Mormon church. I just cannot do that. I find it sexist and, well, frankly, just beyond my ability to endure. I just think it's I'm stuck in the dark ages.
In our case, with our daughter, who is our oldest child, when she was getting ready to leave the nursery and move on into the primary setting, mm-hmm. we started thinking about what she would start to be taught and even what she was absorbing just from going to sacrament meetings, seeing the men sitting up there on the stand and them coming to the podium, conducting the meetings as if, you know, this is a men's church and you're kind of here to be involved in it, but this is a men's church. We're in charge. I didn't want her to get the impression that somehow she was inferior or less competent, than men simply because she was a female.
Right.
I have four daughters, and that was the main reason I knew I had to leave the church. My husband at the time was still a member. My family, extended family, my mom, my sisters, I mean, everybody. But I could not, once I believed it was not true, I couldn't stay for some kind of family peace. I couldn't stay just to keep the peace because I have four daughters, mm-hmm. and I would do anything for them, including leave the only faith I've ever known, if it's necessary for them to reach their full potential. And I think that it's not possible, this is just my opinion, for a woman to reach her full potential in a religion that teaches that men have some kind of divine authority over women, that they have ecclesiastic or familial power over females just because they're men. It just actually makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I found a quote on a blog from I don't know if you guys have been to Mormon Feminist Housewives. Have you ever been to that? It's kind of a blog site for Mormon women. And from my impression of it, they are active Mormon women who are just discussing different issues and stuff. And one of the things that they were talking about was teaching a young women's lesson about, basically, you know, their role to the priesthood, women with the priesthood. I don't know how else to say that. But, one of the comments from a woman was, "I certainly don't understand all the thoughts that are going through my head right now. I look forward to a time when I can ask all my questions, you know, after this life, and get that clarity. I know it's a good plan, because it's God's, but I don't understand why he chose to do things the way they are." So here's an example of a modern Mormon woman who mm-hmm. who basically feels like there are problems, but she can't even ask all her questions until after this life, because this is God's plan, and she can't, even though she doesn't understand it, she feels like she will understand it, you know, sometime later. So I think that's a little sad.
I don't know. I guess we, and maybe this is the, I've been able to, rather successfully compartmentalize, different. There are good parts to the church, and there are parts to the church that I certainly disagree with. We've been able to balance, the good and the bad, with what's going on in the church. I mean, I don't feel like my daughters, have been damaged emotionally and in any way from going to church. They're both very independent young women, very proud of both of them, both continuing their education. My oldest daughter has been on the dean's list for the last three semesters, have to brag about her a little bit, in the theater education program here at one of our state schools. And my other daughter, who's going to be a senior in high school, plans on going into special education. So both of them have had extremely strong career goals, you know, those kinds of things, you know, feel good about themselves. Well, certainly, you know, do not feel downtrodden in any way.
One thing is that to say, for you staying in the church as a more liberal Mormon, is that the only way that the church will change, well, besides from pressure from without, which they have caved into, you know, many times in the past, but one way for the church to change is for people to remain in and help it along, from the inside to.
And that's what I've tried to do. I mean, that really is what I've tried to do. I've had, you know, like I said, we've had small successes, I guess, in that avenue. I'm a pretty strong person, I mean, I'm friendly, but at the same time, I think most of the priesthood holders in our ward know not to, you know, not to mess with me or my kids, or they'll see claws.
So Liz, you talked a lot about compartmentalization, and a lot of the intelligent, dynamic women that I've met in the church often do that sort of thing. You know, there's parts of the doctrine they accept. There's parts that they just say, we'll see, much like you describe. My question now is for the panel, do you all think that can have a negative effect on women in the church, having to live with that sort of compartmentalization, having to live in that sort of dual world?
I think so. I think when I was still an active, member, I felt I didn't feel like I had the freedom to express myself, in, how do I say it? You know, the old excuse, when I'm married, I'll hold the priesthood every night when I hold my husband. You haven't heard that?
No.
Oh yeah.
That's what you get for not being in Utah.
But just trying to convince myself that it was okay for it to be that way, for me not to have the priesthood, I didn't even have to convince myself that it was okay. It just wasn't part of my training. It wasn't even a thought that I would even entertain for a second, because it was not a possibility in any way for me to ever be, one of the leaders of the congregation, like I saw the bishop being. That just was not a possibility. So you don't even think about it.
I agree, Zilpha. And part of it is what's really interesting. It wasn't until I left the church that I really completely understood what I had been living under before, because it was all I had ever known. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anything to compare my experience to. And after I got out, I remember looking back and thinking, I cannot believe I put up with that. I cannot believe I lived with that for so long. And, now I don't believe that the priesthood is real. I don't believe it means anything. I think it's utterly meaningless, frankly, except that holding an office in the priesthood is not meaningless to people, because I think there are certain benefits, there are certain things that come along with those offices that women should be able to experience.
Powers and privileges.
Yes, that they are denied and that they should have. There's other issues in the church that face females that I think are desperately to be addressed. Bishop's interviews. I don't think that a bishop has any business interviewing a teenage girl about her sexuality, about her sins, or whatever he supposes she's done. No business at all behind closed doors with a teenage girl. I experienced that, and I can feel it right now in my mind when I think back about how afraid I was, and how nervous, and how scared, and how I would sit out waiting in the waiting area, waiting to go in and talk to the bishop. It terrified me. I think it's a horrible practice, and something should be done to stop that for these little girls that have to go in there.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised.
Not enough for the boys, but for girls to go in and speak to a 35-year-old man when they're 17, which was my experience, it's creepy.
Yeah, I am surprised that the church has allowed that to continue with lawsuits that have inevitably occurred from having, a male and a female in one room without other presence.
I mean, I can only tell you how I have handled that particular situation with my own kids, and whether that be a quote right or wrong way, it is, my way.
What did you do?
That I have handled that, basically. I have just told, I have just told both girls, you're not, you don't say any, just you, that, that's just not, there's no reason to have to go to, quote, confess anything to the bishop along the lines of sexuality. We have a pretty close relationship. Thank heavens, they do feel comfortable talking to me about those kinds of things. And there is a high confidentiality there. And there have been things that they have talked to me about that, and that's as far as it will go.
Well, good for you.
That's something. I have had my share of conversations, with the bishoprics in our ward too, that they know better. Basically, it's just like, okay, you just don't surround the Liz's kids. We're just gonna just leave them alone. Because I'm always very much, I know the questions. I know the questions that you're supposed to ask. Stick to the questions.
Right.
Don't deter. You start deterring from the questions, you're gonna have a problem with me.
Okay, I'd like to shift gears a little bit here. We've been talking about authority in the church, which is obviously an important issue. There seems to be another large issue in the church with women, and that is with the pressure on LDS women in particular. And I acknowledge this is also a big American thing, to be everything to everybody all the time. Meaning they have to excel in their careers, they have to be beautiful, they have to be great homemakers, they have to be good at toll painting and doing crafts and everything in
the
world.
Their children always have to be dressed impeccably and act impeccably.
I think, you know, and maybe it was turning 40 that did this for me. I'm not really sure. But I think the biggest, I just learned to say no. And that was the most empowering thing to be able to do, was just to, you know, damn it. I will do what, you know, I will do what is feasible for me to do. And that applies to callings. That applies to everything. You know, as far as the church goes, I have had bishops ask me, you know, in other words, I do not feel guilty about being asked to do something. And if it is not something that is going to be feasible for, in other words, it's going to be more of a burden to my family or to our particular situation, then I have no problem saying no. And there is no amount of guilt that you can try and put on me that is going to change that. And I don't know whether, you know, it's, you know, one of those things where, you know, you get like, what's the movie? Danny Glover and Mel Gibson, we're too old for this.
Lethal Weapon?
Lethal Weapon. Yeah. I'm too old for this.
Well, that's a great attitude to have, but I'm not sure that all women, even have the, I don't know, emotional wherewithal to be that strong against it?
Well, kind of, I think what broke me of the need to be perfect in the church was coming to a point where I could physically no longer do it when I hurt my back and I had two little babies, and I realized I can't be perfect. I'm not perfect. And I just can't worry about it. But I still, you know, I still felt a lot of pressure to put on the picture of perfection. Mm-hmm. When I went to church, you know, that was the time I tried to, you know, get my makeup all on and have my kids dressed cute and hope that they would behave for the meetings and stuff like that.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I will never forget reading part of Marie Osmond's autobiography, I think, that she wrote, or an article or something, where she basically had a breakdown. She went mass depression and had a complete breakdown. And I will never forget her, you know, it was just heart wrenching to hear her say, but I put my lipstick on and did what my mother always told me to do. And that was to smile, you know,
And I experienced the same issues. I think all women experience that pressure to some extent.
Oh, absolutely.
But I do think it is a little bit greater in the Mormon church. And now that I've been outside of it, I've attended other churches. I do think the pressure is greater there. And what's funny is I also think it's probably a regional issue. I'm from the South, I think there's a little more kind of an old-fashioned attitude about women that still exists here. And I have a hard time shaking it still. You know, I mean, I'm from the South. Women here just tend to do what they need to do. Pretty gritty, pretty tough ladies here.
Yeah.
But still, there was something in Mormonism that I see. Yeah. I see my active friends frazzled, worn out. They haven't had their hair done in I don't know how long. You know, they need a pedicure. They don't take care of themselves.
Yeah.
And they wear themselves out. Their husbands are clueless.
Well,
and they are killing themselves to be exactly what everyone thinks they ought to be.
I have a situation. One of the gals who I visit taught, this was three years ago. Cause it was the same summer that my oldest daughter was graduating from high school. So I remember I had my dad here from California. He was staying with us for about a month for the graduation. So we had, I mean, you talk about, it was all go at our house. And in addition to graduating, my daughter also had the lead in the play that they were doing at the school. And it was insanity, like it always is. And I was teaching full time over at the college too. So it was really crazy. The gal who I visit taught, she had a hip replacement, and we did not, it was really a bad situation all the way around, because the doctor was not completely honest with her about the kind of care that she was going to need after the surgery was complete, which basically included round the clock care once she got home. I would have strangled her husband if I could have gotten a hold of him. I had to be held back by several people, because he was actually substitute teaching at the time. He's retired. He was substitute teaching at the time, so he didn't really have to go work every day. He had a choice. I mean, you know, I understand that may have been a little bit of extra money, but at the same time, you know, that was not something that he really, really had to do every day. I calendared the sisters in the church rallied. I will say the sisters in the ward rallied. I can't, and I used my Excel spreadsheet. We calendared. We had round the clock help for this sister from the time she got up and, you know, until her physical therapist got there and until her husband got home from work and all of that. We had a system set up like that for, probably a good 2 months while she was recovering. But I was very frustrated that her husband was not more involved. I mean, basically he was just very, compliant or complacent with allowing us to do that. I mean, not that it wasn't that I minded do. I mean, I was a visiting teacher and I certainly wasn't going to let her suffer. And we were certainly going to do everything we could to help her. But it just seemed like this husband was, I mean, he still, like, they were called as temple workers. He would go to the temple by himself at night and, you know, just leave her there and expect us to find somebody to come in and, you know, and, you know, be with her when she couldn't be by herself during those times, you know, and I'm thinking, what in the hell is wrong with you?
You know, the errand of...
This is your husband. I mean, this is your wife. I mean, if my husband, you know, my husband would never do that. He would never do that to me.
The errand of angels is given to women. And that's what the song says. Well, so he might just feel like it's like an opportunity for women to serve. He wouldn't want to rob them of that.
You know, in the beginning, we were talking about the divided roles, that there's things that the men do, and they're, you know, largely the administration of the church, the holding the priesthood, the lot of that thing. Then there's this space over here that's allotted for women. And we, of course, talked about in history that's sort of changed a little bit. I think there, besides that, I think there's a lot of men who think, oh, that's the domain of women, so they don't worry about it. I mean, the classic sort of women's work sort of sexist view where the woman's in the kitchen, you know, I'm going to go to priesthood meeting and that's it. And we've obviously talked about some of those. I also think that there...
You need to come to my house.
I think your house is the exception.
Yeah, atypical.
I think it's more than I do.
We all pitch in. It's not, I mean, I do laundry for myself and for the five and for my five-year-old, and everybody else does their own. I mean,
yeah, but yes. That's atypical, I think, amongst Mormon families.
The other observation I was going to make.
I think this is the way it should be.
I think that's true.
I think you're probably right.
I think there's a lot of things in the church that the women tend to do that the men sometimes. You know, speaking as a man, will think that women go above and beyond in an unnecessary sort of role. For example, the classic example is that, you know, the men barely crack the manual before they teach the lesson. But women will very much, you know, prepare their lessons for Relief Society and have visual aids and you know, decorate the room and spend a lot more time and
make
energy.
Make cookies.
You know, for feeding the missionaries, for example, women will take a lot of effort and the men will be more like, well, no one fed me when I was on a mission. Let them eat their own food. So I think sometimes that this goes to that pressure that women feel in the church to overperform or maybe to outperform the others. I don't know what it is, but I don't think the men always share that goal.
It's the only way it's the only way I felt like I could really express myself at church. It was, I didn't have any kind of, you know, ecclesiastical role. I wasn't involved in the structure. I didn't have any authority over, you know, I couldn't use any other talents really except cooking or making a lesson or doing the things I was allowed to do. So I think we do the very best with what we can, you know, try to use our talents in the way that we're allowed, even if that way is a very narrowly defined little
niche. There was a long period of time where I really struggled testimony wise, and I hid, I guess you would say, with my music. And even today, probably my absolute favorite calling is playing the piano for primary. I mean, that is just awesome, because for me, I've been playing the piano since I was 8 years old. I don't have to think about it. It's something I can just go in and play the piano for 2 hours and not really think about it. And I just get to giggle at all the kids' antics. And
but I loved doing that job also until I started listening to the words that I was of the songs I was playing. Uh-huh. And I couldn't do that calling anymore either, because I was encouraging some of the attitudes that I didn't believe in the children by playing the piano for them. But anyway, I want to talk about a little bit about depression and Mormon women. Have you guys, do you feel like there's maybe more of an issue amongst Mormon women? Are they?
I think what is a shame, I think now as far as depression goes, I think that as a society, we still see depression as something that is controllable, and we should be beyond, you know, you know, there is still that real stigma even among society. It's starting to change, but it's still there. I think that is magnified even more within the church. And, you know, kind of stemming off of that, one thing that has been very difficult for me over the last year and a half, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia. And that is still a condition that doctors are still learning about. It's very difficult to pinpoint. They don't really know why you get it, or, you know, that kind of thing. They have different theories. What they basically think probably triggered it in me was having a baby as late in life as I did. I was almost 40 when I had my son. And so they think it was something hormonal that kicked in. But basically, I go through, I feel like I have the flu all the time. Body aches just continually, continually in this pain all the time. And yet, I'm still trying to function. I have a voice studio. I'm trying to run, I teach college classes. I have kids. I'm a musical director for a show right now. There are a lot of things that I have going on that I'm trying to balance. And, you still get this a lot of, and when my husband first found out that I had this, it was very disheartening to me because he really for a long time until I sat down with him and actually showed him information and we talked to the doctor together about it. He really thought it was all in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot, unfortunately, there are hypochondriacs out there. There are people who do take advantage of, that situation or whatever. But I think, unfortunately, the dichotomy in the church, I see a lot more of that happening, and that's heartbreaking. That is, it's definitely not right. I get very upset about that.
So you're saying that women in the church who have depression,
hide it. They won't get help because they feel ashamed of the, they feel like they should be able to control it. It's just like, Marie Osmond's, going back to the example of Marie Osmond's breakdown. She felt like she should have been able to get a handle on it herself.
Well, according to the church doctrine of free will, you should be able to, but,
But you can't. There are medical,
What, Kimberly?
Being depressed is that's a medical. That is a clinical condition, just like breaking your arm. It's just something that you can't physically see, and that is what is so frustrating.
What, Kimberly Ann?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to add that something I felt as a Mormon, and I don't think my feelings are out of line. I felt like things were my fault, because I wasn't righteous enough, or I wasn't doing enough. I felt like if I was unhappy or sad, or if things weren't going how they should be, or if my testimony was wavering, it was because I wasn't living my life, as I should. That maybe there was something I should have been doing better. Mm-hmm. So I was constantly, I blame myself for every little thing that happened because I must not be a faithful enough. Or maybe if I said my morning and evening prayer, maybe I was only saying my evening prayer. And I always had some little reason why things wouldn't be going the way they should. And it was always my fault because I was always taught that. If something's wrong, you're not counting your blessings. If something's wrong and you're feeling depressed, you're just not thankful enough.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a real downer for me, but I couldn't even express that. Well, because that was wrong too.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. I see that. I definitely see that and have felt that in different points in my life too. Again, I think, I've gotten to the point now at 40, it's kind of like, people are just going to have to, God and everyone else is just going to have to accept me for the way I am. And, either they will or they won't. And I'm not going to change. So,
but some women put up with that feeling, all that pressure. They never come to the point where you have, they have that pressure their whole lives. That's how their whole lives are. And I wish it wasn't so.
I agree.
So too.
I agree.
And then so many of them, like myself when I was a Mormon, I felt like I didn't even have anything to look forward to after I died. Even that seemed miserable.
More of the same.
More of the same. More babies. Babies forever and ever. And I love babies more than anyone I know, I think. I absolutely adore children. I don't just love them. I like them. But I don't want to have them. You know,
forever and ever.
Well, that particular,
and
you know,
picked me after, and I thought, wow, my whole life I'm going to struggle and work and put myself second. I'm going to be in this church where I'm sometimes unhappy, but of course that was my own fault, I thought. And then when I die, I have nothing better to even look forward to.
I guess with, you know, the one thing that I can't, and I don't know why or how I was able to come to that conclusion, as young as I did, I guess I have always felt that Brigham Young was wrong with that particular, you know, with that particular standing that, polygamy, that every, you know, that basically, in order to achieve the highest degree of glory in the celestial kingdom, you had to, participate in polygamy. And also just the whole concept of creating, I mean, my whole thought has always been, you know, as far as continuing to have children, I mean, why the that whole concept of sex forever? I mean, you know, I'm like, well, yeah, that part, you know, the sex part forever isn't a bad thing. I can deal with that. but as far as the you know, pregnancy side of it, why, if you're a glorified being, why would that be the only way that you could create others? That never, ever made sense to me. And I guess I just always felt like, you know what? Somebody got that wrong. I mean, I get that, just, you know, it was like, you know what? That doesn't make sense. I think everyone's going to be really surprised in the next life when they find out that that's a bunch of baloney.
That was all one big joke.
So I don't know. That always, one thing that, and this is just kind of switching gears, but I wanted to bring it up before I forgot. And Kim, we tease you a little bit on Shade's discussion board about being the, you know, the cupcake queen, you know, and I absolutely love that story, because we've all kind of experienced that, you know, that type of, quote, morality lesson in some way. And one positive, I think, that has evolved is that I really cannot see that kind of lesson being taught in young women's today. And I think if it was taught, it would be a similar situation to, kind of like what happened. I think Harmony told me, her group, they had somebody that did it in her group, and the girls all ate the cupcakes anyway.
Kimberly.
I mean, you share drinks and all. I mean, you know, teenagers, good grief, you share sodas and everything. So who cares? Yeah, we'll all eat the cupcakes anyway. It doesn't matter.
You know? Kimberly, for those who are unaware, maybe you should, briefly let them in on the cupcake story.
On the cupcake story. Kimberly, okay. That privilege of being the cupcake queen.
Yes. The cupcake story, it's similar to all the other really bad analogies we had in church. There wasn't just lit cupcakes, object lessons. Right?
Yes.
There wasn't just lit cupcakes. There were dog poop brownies. Do you remember the dog? Did anyone else have
brownies?
No, no, we didn't do that. Our version of the lit cupcake story, and that was when you said it. I just died laughing when I read that for the first time. Our version of it was actually with a salad. And one of the leaders spit in the salad. And I mean, you know, just hoisted a loogie in the salad. It was really gross.
Well, they're all the same disgusting lessons. You have chewed gum. Right. You have, you know, sometimes they'll, you know, lick a candy and want to try to put it in someone else's mouth. Right. The licked cupcakes have represented young women in young women's class. We did it in young women's. And the teacher brought just enough cupcakes so that everyone would have one. And then she took one of the cupcakes and licked a bunch of frosting off the top, put the cupcake down, and then passed the cupcakes along. And the last person was stuck with the licked cupcake. And in our case, the girl wouldn't eat the cupcake. And the whole point to the lesson was, you don't want to be a yucky licked cupcake. You know,
nobody will choose you.
Yeah, no one will want you. You're gross, you know. And the thing is, I think that is such a disgusting lesson to give to young women. And the lesson that the young'un had, and this lesson was given to young men even when I was an adult in teaching young women. They gave this lesson to the young men.
Yeah,
they had a cake, the destroyed cake.
Tell that one.
They would punch the middle and say how yucky the cake was. It had been used by someone else. It had been sullied. You don't want this yucky cake. The cake represented a female. Don't do anything
horrible
with a girl, because you'll ruin her and make her gross for someone else who should, you know, maybe be her husband.
Who deserves
who won't
to have
her because you've used her.
Oh, man.
And that lesson was probably 7 or 8 years ago with the cake that the boys got, that someone from the Mormon apologetics discussion board said that just last year their daughter got that sullied cake lesson at young women's camp.
Really?
The lessons are still, if you Google them, you will see they're still floating around all over the place. Huh. And it's just one more symptom of the church's sexist, narrow view of females.
Mm-hmm.
I never got a lesson telling me that boys who had premarital sex were gross and used goods.
Now, actually,
never.
We did. In my ward in California growing up, and maybe that was because my dad was the young men's president at the time.
He shouldn't have had one. I'm glad I didn't, I guess.
It went both ways as far as my dad was, their lessons were pretty much, hey, you know, You don't want to do that, you know. They were as stern with the young men as they were young women about it.
I think
the young men are taught to remain chaste. I don't disagree with that at all. I know that they're taught that lesson, but at least when I was growing up, there's a distinction in that the young men were taught to mind their own business, you know, to keep morally clean. So they can go on mission so that things, you know, that they could be chaste. But the girls and the boys were both somehow taught that girls who were not pure were really disgusting. You know, and I think that's where they really cross the line in that kind of teaching.
I think that matches my experience growing up also, the type of things you're saying. And, you know, also the boys are obviously taught morality, but nothing like the girls are, who recite it every week, you know, for the young men, it's a passing topic.
That whole thing that's going on right now, I do think that is very bizarre.
What's the
whole,
Liz? You might know what's the new term they added? Was it
the whole I don't to be honest, I couldn't recite it to you.
They have an eighth value now, right? That's morality or purity.
Or the Heavenly Father who loves us and we love Him. We will stand as one. I can recite it.
Yeah, they just
added a new part.
Yeah, you're
to
better
it.
Than, hey, geez, and you've been.
They just added a new value, which is clearly about sexual morality. Yeah, so I mean, the point being that it's obviously much more emphasized among the young ladies. And since these are values, and value obviously means worth,
sure.
That sexuality is tied up in the at least for the young women in their sexual identity, which obviously is going to create problems when you have to switch gears 180 degrees on your wedding night and go from being something that's dirty and impure and something that makes you unworthy to something that's
supposed
whatever
to
it
be.
Becomes. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of issues with Mormon women, when they reach that wedding night and beyond in their sexual relationship with their partner, feeling like it's okay.
Oh, absolutely. I agree.
And not feeling, you know, somehow immoral for having sex even with their husband, or enjoying it. Enjoying sex with their partner can make them feel guilty, I think.
Well, sexuality and Mormonism and female sexuality in general is probably a whole nother topic for a whole nother day. There's endless, I'm trying to think of some metaphor that won't sound like a double entendre. But I'll just let it at that. All right. You know, I think it's been a really great discussion. I think, Liz, you've given, especially for those who, remain in the church, probably some excellent models to follow in terms of, how to really contextualize and live with those things. I think for both Kimberly Ann and Zilpha, I think you've described some of the reality that many women inside and outside the church feel day in and day out, and given us all lots of things to think about.
It's been fun. I've really enjoyed it. It's been great talking with you guys. Love to do this again sometime.
Thank you, Zilpha and John and Elizabeth. It was a great conversation.
It's awesome.
I enjoyed it. We'll there's some of these topics we'll have to explore in more depth in the future. I really enjoyed it. Thanks again for participating. Remember, the discussion continues at mormonexpression.com. Check out the blog there for links to the information discussed and continue the discussion. You can call and leave a comment at 801-906-6722, or you can email us your comments or audio for future podcasts in mail at mormonexpression.com. Our music is provided by Kevin MacLeod at incomitech.com.
Sex.
Absolutely.